Welcome back to The Full Cat with Bruce Dobigan, and welcome back to our subscribers at AnticaNetwork.com. The current immigration debate is causing waves in both Canada and the United States. Donald Trump's election was in part due to the promise of building a wall against Mexico and reviewing immigration from a number of nations with majority Muslim populations. In Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is determined to stay the course on his ambitious plans to bring in refugees. Some are already coming across the border from the United States. The left wing is in the streets to protest immigration. The right wing, however, is revisiting a crucial schism from the 1990s when anti-immigration factors were purged from the establishment of the Republican Party. Those in favor of a very limited immigration were in the wilderness until Donald Trump rode their message to the White House. One of the prominent members of this group is author Peter Brimelow. His book Alien Nation in 1996 made the case for closing borders to preserve the social and political nature of North America. It also resulted in him being fired from the National Review, the conservative oracle started by William F. Buckley. In 1999, Brimelow started a website called vdare.com. It's named after Virginia Dare. She was the first white English child born in the New World. He's been labeled as everything from a defender of traditional American values to a racist over the content on the website. He's also worked extensively in Canada in the past. His 1996 book, Patriot Games, is considered to have been the inspiration for the reform movement in Canada's conservative community. It was one that resulted in Stephen Harper's decade as the Prime Minister. Peter Brimelow joins us this week from Connecticut on The Full Cat with Bruce Dobigan. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me on, Bruce.
Good. I've given you a little of the bio there, but tell us, for people who knew you when you were in Canada, tell us what you've been doing since.
Well, you know, Bruce, I came to Canada in, I think, 1972, after I got out of the business school at Stanford. And I was there for most of the 70s, for all the 70s, really. I left in late 1979. And I worked, I was a financial journalist with the old Financial Post and with Maclean's magazine. In the U.S., I worked on the Senate staff. And then I went back into financial journalism, and I continued really until a couple of years ago, primarily as a financial journalist for Fortune and Forbes and Barron's, and latterly I did a column for Dow Jones Market Watch on very arcane investment issues. But you know, one of the things about this immigration debate is it's not really possible to maintain a presence in the mainstream media, to have a career in the mainstream media, if you're on the wrong side of the immigration debate. Dan Stein, who is the head of the Federation of American Immigration Reform, warned me of this. You know, when I wrote my immigration book, which is now 20 years ago, as you say, we call it the curse of Stein. Almost everybody who gets involved in the immigration issue on the wrong side, the politically incorrect side, ends up being purged.
Well, tell me how it is that you arrived at the philosophy that you had. What was it, the central thing that sort of pushed you in that direction to this philosophy, which, as you say, is not a popular one at the moment?
Well, you know, it's not a popular one, but of course, with the advent of the internet, journalism has sort of been disintermediating. We've been liberated, in this country at least, in the U.S. at least, where the market is very deep, from corporate journalism. And so we've been basically running the VDare Foundation now, and VDare website, webzine, since 1999. And we've been able to make the case for what we call patriotic immigration reform since then. And we have now quite a lot of, we've been joined by a lot of people, most notably, of course, Ann Coulter, whose wonderful book, Adios America, had this tremendous impact on Trump.
Yeah,
but to answer your question, I guess I'm just naturally contrary. The consensus in favor of immigration from all the politically correct people was so great that it just got on my nerves in North America. But I was enormously influenced, to name one single thing, by Enoch Powell and his great speech in 1968, which is always called the Rivers of Blood speech, although he didn't actually say that, basically attacking non-traditional immigration into Britain. And that speech, although it's conventionally said to have ruined his career, I don't think he did, but that's another matter. That speech really succeeded in holding at bay immigration, mass immigration to Britain, really until Tony Blair opened the floodgates 10 years ago.
Try to explain to our audience, your definition of what the immigration policy should be. I'm presuming you would say the same thing for Canada as for America. What is the standard that you would have?
Actually, it's true across the first world, across the industrialized first world. I mean, the overwhelming evidence from labor economists, and as I say, I worked in financial journalism for 40 years, is that this great influx of immigration that we see everywhere in the first world now essentially doesn't benefit the native-born, the people already living in the country, at all. The so-called immigration surplus is vanishingly small. It does increase GDP, but the great bulk of that is captured by the immigrants themselves in the form of wages. However, it has a secondary effect, which is actually quite evil in its workings, which is that it causes a massive shift of GDP from labor to capital. In the US, it's of the order of like 2 to 3%. So that's a very big number. So basically, what we see in the first world at the moment is an alliance between, on the one hand, the owners of capital, and on the other hand, professional ethnic entrepreneurs who want to build up their own ethnic groups for rent-seeking purposes against the working class. Yeah. Immigration has been a major... Immigration in the US was kicked off, really, by the 65 Immigration Act, which came into force about 1968. And since then, incomes for the great majority of Americans have simply stagnated. There are several reasons for this, but immigration is one of them.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big deal that Charles Murray has talked about a little bit in his books as well.
I've known Murray for many years. I have to say, he was very slow to reach this conclusion, because he wanted to stay on the right side of. I'm afraid he wanted to stay. He'd done enough damage to himself with the bell curve that he didn't want to go any further. But he has now moved in that direction, really under the impact of Trump. He wouldn't listen to me, but he listened to Trump.
Yeah. What is your recipe for how much immigration is enough immigration?
I think what we've got to do right now across the first world, but particularly in American Canada, is simply have immigration moratoriums. That is to say, no net immigration. In the U.S., maybe 200,000-300,000 people leave every year in the U.S. So if you could have 200,000-300,000 people coming in, and you wouldn't have any net immigration. And that would take care of any hardship case so desperately needed skills, much exaggerated, of course. That might be needed. Ironically, that's not far from the influx in the U.S. that Teddy Kennedy predicted when he put through the Immigration Act in 1965. He was just totally wrong. So that's what we need. We need an immigration pause, a moratorium, for a long time until we figure out what we actually want to do. And in my, the case against immigration that we make at VDare.com is very broad, and there's a lot of issues in it, and a lot of people from different political traditions who have a reason for supporting immigration restriction. For example, the labor unions used to support this because it busts down workers' wages. Yeah. It used to be a left-wing cause, immigration restriction. But in any case, I was going to make the additional point, and this is not popular with some of our supporters, or they're too frightened to get into it, is I don't think the government should be monkeying around with the racial balance of the country. I mean, in the U.S., basically, the government is literally abolishing the people and electing a new one. In 1965, U.S. was 90% white. It's now somewhere below 70% white. It's hard to tell because the census data is so poorly designed. Right. And that's entirely because of public policy. The government is basically driving the historic American nation into a minority. And whites will go into a minority in this country by 2040 or so. Now, as I say, there's no economic rationale for this, whatever, except unless you happen to be a wealthy capitalist like Zuckerberg at Facebook, in which case you get cheaper workers. Well, but overall, there's no economic rationale for it at all. So the question is, why are we doing it? Why are we remaking the demographics of the country like this? You can see why the Democrats are doing it. Yeah. You can see why the Canadian Liberals are doing it. They think they're going to be able to colonize these third world people who are coming in for votes. The Democrats openly said that they were going to become the majority party in the country because of immigration. They've simply given up appealing to the white working class in this country. But why are Americans as a whole, or for that matter Canadians as a whole, supposed to put up with it?
What about the racial balance that we do have in the United States, 12-13% black, the Latino community, etc.? Do they have a place in this America you're talking about?
Well, as I say, what I'm afraid of is immigration moratorium until we figure out what to do. So, obviously, these people will still be there.
You're being called a racist, so I'm trying to.
Trying to find out. I mean, I'm not making any plans to remove any populations. I think the United States is going to break up, but that's not because I want it to happen. I think it will happen because of the divisions that have been introduced by public policy. Mm-hmm. The only populations that I have malign intent towards or hostile intent towards are the illegals. They should simply be removed, and that can be done easily simply by enforcing the law. They'll self-deport.
Yeah, I mean, the logistics of deporting 11 million people at the moment are, you know, it's a fairly tendentious argument.
It's easy. No, it's not a problem at all. They came in, didn't they? They can leave. Was that they can leave by themselves if you enforce the law. You make it impossible. You enforce the law against employing illegal aliens in the workplace, right. And also you remove the very substantial government subsidies that there are towards illegal aliens right now, and they will leave. People they came and they can go.
So it's not
something that requires a lot of effort. I think there should be more deportations. I think, for example, every time the Democrats put up an illegal alien to speak at one of their conventions, they should be immediately arrested and thrown out.
Right.
But that's what we call the strategic deportation, because it sends a message. But I don't see, there was a huge illegal immigration crisis in the U.S. in the early 1950s. And Eisenhower, when he came into office, ended it in 18 months with what they called then Operation Wetback. 1.5 million people left the country, but very few of them were actually deported. It was only like 200,000 as far as I can see. The great majority simply left when they realized the game was up.
What's the responsibility of a first world nation like Canada or the United States when we have compassionate cases about refugees who are displaced in other places? Is there no
This refugee stuff is just a bunch of bunk. What they are is expedited, subsidized, politically favored immigration flows. They come into this country ahead of everybody else, and they can immediately go on welfare, and they do. And that's why you see the refugees enormously entangled in welfare, and they never get off it. It's a complete ineffective way of conducting any kind of a humanitarian mission. There are literally millions of people in trouble all over the world. The number that could conceivably come into the U.S. Or for that matter, Canada, is extremely small. The government likes it. The Obama administration likes the refugee flow because they had it set up that they could plant these people in all kinds of Republican areas with the obvious intention of eventually swamping them. Mm-hmm. And they did it in collusion with capitalists. I mean, the owners of meatpacking companies and so on would actually contract with the government to get refugees as cheap labor. And they would dump them in these small towns in Iowa and in the Midwest and so on. There's nothing compassionate or humanitarian about this. It's a racket. It's a political racket because they want votes, and it's an economic racket because the capitalists don't want to pay Americans a living wage. Bruce, why Africa was partitioned, the partition of Africa in the late 19th century. That was essentially done for humanitarian reasons. The missionaries wanted the U.S., wanted the metropolitan powers to stop the slave trade, right, in Africa, which had been largely run by Arabs. Now, the point is, if these areas in chaos, these areas that were in chaos, were ruled by the metropolitan powers, by Europe and so on, until after the Second World War, and they were relatively peaceful and stable then. You know, you can't have responsibility without power. If we withdraw from these areas in Africa, the Middle East, and so on, and the people start eating each other there, there's nothing we can do in the end except go back in, which we don't want to do.
Yeah.
So there's nothing we can do about these humanitarian problems. They just have to work themselves out.
You're listening to The Full Count with Bruce Dobigan. Our guest today is author Peter Brimelow. I guess one of the great surprises of the election, at least surprises to the establishment, was just how Mr. Trump's message on immigration resonated and got him to the presidency. Give us a sense of how his work is going, how he's doing on this front.
in a symbolic sense, he's doing great. I mean, he's raising the issues and forcing debate on them. What he said in his speech to Congress, by the way, a week or so ago, he continues to surprise. He there raised the question of reforming legal immigration, the legal immigration inflow by moving to a merit system. So from that point of view, I think he's done well. I think in terms of executive action, he's done the best he can. There's obviously a huge clash coming in this country between the judiciary and the executive branch. The American judiciary has become increasingly unrestrained and sees more and more power, really going back 60 years now. And at some point, there's going to be a huge fist fight over this between the executive branch and the judiciary. Certainly, probably at least the largest since the Roosevelt court packing fight, and actually maybe even going back to Jackson. There's going to be a huge fight about that. But at the moment, he's started off well. My problem with Trump is I don't think he aims high enough. I mean, for example, there's absolutely no reason whatever why the Americans can't have a ban on all Muslim immigration if they want. It's absurd to say it's unconstitutional. The U.S. is a sovereign power. They can choose whoever they want to come in. But he's not done that. He's tried to finesse the issue by using country bans or increased scrutiny on the inflow from specific countries. He's not done them any good, of course. I think he should have gone to a Muslim ban. I think also that he should flat out call for an immigration moratorium, which he's not yet done. Right. There is a bill in Congress put forward by Senator Cotton which calls for reducing immigration by half, and that's a substantial step. Yeah. But it's no more substantial than the Jordan Commission we recommended nearly 20 years ago and was envisioned in what they then called the Smith-Simpson bill, which was sabotaged during the Clinton administration, actually largely by Republican no-goodniks. Progress is quite slow. I'd like to see him shoot higher. What he is doing is he's making people talk about the issue. And the big problem we have on immigration, ever since Berkeley Purge National Review, really, is that it simply wasn't possible to get discussion about immigration into the mainstream media. It's gone completely underground into the catacombs of the internet.
How much of your complaint about the immigrant communities that we're talking about is race based, and how much of it is values based?
Well, the answer to that is yes. I mean, and as I say, the people who are opposed, the critics of immigration in this country are very, very varied. They come from all kinds of different political traditions. It's a coalition. I do think that values the different values of some of these groups are problems. Quite obviously, Muslim immigration is a problem because it's very hard for an observant Muslim to tolerate living in a non-Sharia society. So that's a values problem. But you know, Bruce, the fact is that race is a proxy for values. People differ systematically on all kinds of things that are based on race. So on the whole, I think it would have been much better if we'd kept the white population of the U.S. at 90%. It would be a much happier society. And it would have been better for the blacks, by the way. I mean, I don't see quite what good it's done. American blacks are now no longer the largest minority. This peculiar category of Hispanic is the largest minority. I say it's peculiar because it's defined in such a way by the census to maximize the number of Hispanics. If you have a Spanish surname, you're likely to be counted Hispanic, even though you may have lived in the U.S. for hundreds of years and be as white as I am. Yeah. They do everything they can to maximize the size of that minority group, but it is the largest minority group. And what good has that done American blacks? It's astounding to me that they're still for it.
When you say white and black, in these cases, are we talking about race here and a homogenous white population, and their values are superior to others? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, they're different from others. I mean, I think that the U.S. In 1965, it had assembled from various parts of the world, but predominantly from Northern Europe and from Britain, a functioning nation, and the nation had control of a state. Yeah. It was what we call a nation state. They had not assimilated the black population at that point, but they were working on it. You could see every index of economic progress and so on, the blacks had been improving really until the 1960s. They've actually stalled since the 60s because of this increased competition from unskilled workers, which falls particularly hard on them.
I suspect that what the complaint is about your philosophy is that somehow we're talking about values that are intrinsic to whites that are superior to values of Muslims or blacks or something else. And I guess I'm asking you, is that the case?
Well, as, let me start by saying that Vida.com is a coalition. It's a forum site that will run anybody who from any political tradition, you know, who is critical of the current immigration policy, current immigration policy. So we do have Hispanics writing for us. For example, we had a Mexican-American writing recently for us, complaining bitterly about the new influx of Mexican-Americans and how it did, the damage it inflicted on her community, you know. But I'm not going to back away from this issue. I personally think that you know, the bell curve is right. Race does matter. Right. So if you import people from very, very, very different racial traditions, you're asking for trouble. Yeah. Diversity is not strength, it's weakness. Yeah. I mean, I can say this now, Bruce. You know, I'm 70 years old. I have this independent. We have this independent website. It's a struggle because we keep getting dropped by advertisers and so on. But we have people who support us, and so I think we can face these issues frankly. I mean, the debate that should have taken place in the wake of the publication of the Bell Curve, which quite clearly, you know, it wasn't originally. It just summarized the evidence that there are significant racial differences in IQ and so on. That debate has never taken place. That debate's never taken place.
We're not talking about one race being superior to the other. We're talking about races having different worldviews. Is that your point?
Yeah, characteristics. There's some type of relationship between ethnicity and culture, which is very hard to disentangle. Yeah. But as a practical matter, ethnicity and culture can be treated as more or less the same. Yeah. When you say superior, you know, as I say, it's not a question necessarily of superiority or ethnicity. It's a question of differences in taste.
Right.
So the reason we have a federal government in this country is because the founders saw that human beings are not totally homogenous. They're not totally interchangeable. They tend to develop separate communities. Mm. And so they wanted to have those communities represented. They don't just go for a headcount in formal government. They actually try to make sure that there's a balance between the different communities so that they're not the smaller communities are not swamped by the larger communities. Mm. And if that was so within what was then a totally white society, because obviously, at the time of the revolution, although there were blacks in the country, the only people who got to vote were whites.
Right.
It's not only a totally white society, but it was an overwhelmingly Protestant society and heavily British society. But they still saw the variations developing and they saw the need to accommodate them. Mm-hmm. Well, we need that's much more so now. With the divergences that have been introduced by public policy. But in fact, we're moving in exactly the opposite direction. The government's trying to get more and more centralized.
Clearly, you haven't taken this position to get more popular or to get rich. So this is not an expeditious decision that you've made here. Obviously, it's one you've made out of conviction. I think you've intimated that several times here. I know that you're having trouble with Facebook carrying some of your stuff. We've also seen the riots at Berkeley and the inauguration, which you attended, by the way, and the disruptions on campuses like Middlebury College. What is your sense about the intimidation of thought in the United States?
I think we're headed for civil war in this country, Bruce. I think that the divisions are so profound now. And the American left has become increasingly extreme and totalitarian. I don't see any way of resolving it. This is a country where people are armed. At some point, there's going to be one of these demonstrations like at Berkeley and so on. Or these attacks on Trump demonstrators, you know. Yeah. There's several. They had these Trump demonstrations last weekend, pro-Trump demonstrations. And several of them were attacked, not just the Berkeley one. Mm-hmm. Well, one day, somebody's going to pull out a gun and start shooting. Then other people are going to start shooting back and we'll be off to the races. There's going to be a hard landing here. The only way to stop it is to shut down immigration immediately. But we'll see if that can happen.
I know you've been out of Canada for a while now. Pierre Trudeau had just left office when you wrote Patriot Games. Must be a little strange to look up now and see that his son is the Prime Minister of Canada after all the thought you gave to his father.
Well, you know, Bruce, I often say that all modern political diseases were invented in Canada. I mean, multiculturalism and bilingualism and things that the Americans only just begin to grapple with, have been around for a long time in Canada. From the point of view of the analysis that I had in the Patriot game, Stephen Harper was the sort of the end game there. because he did what I said he could do, what could be done, which was to win the election from English Canada. Unfortunately, and this requires some more thinking about, I don't think that Harper seized his opportunities. He wasn't able to build. I mean, I personally think that Quebec should be thrown out of Confederation. I don't think it's a question of them seceding. They should be thrown out like the Czechs threw the Slovaks out of Czechoslovakia. Good fences make good neighbors. I think that would make now we see what you'd have now in Canada without Quebec is another minority government. Even assuming that Trudeau had been able to win Ontario and get himself back into the West and so on.
You said that Pierre Trudeau wasn't a particularly clever or wise man, but he was a great man, perhaps the greatest that Canada produced in the 20th century. What did you mean by that?
I think he had tremendous capacities of courage and will. And he wasn't somebody who looked at public opinion polls and so on. And he was able to impose himself on society. He was a real leader. I think the solution he came up with, which was this attempt to... and I think he, in some sense, actually seriously believed that Canada was bicultural and bilingual society. Which, you know, it is possible to think that if you... I mean, you're from Quebec yourself. If you're in Quebec... It's possible to think that because so many Anglos in Quebec do speak French, particularly now. But as you know, west of Ottawa, and particularly west of the Lakehead, that's just not the case. You're living in a substantially Anglophone society. And I actually think that one of the reasons for the Canadian Liberal Party moving to massive immigration, as you know, almost proportionally immigration actually larger into Canada than it is into the US, is because they were trying to find some way of breaking down Anglophone Canada. They wanted to try and establish bases in Anglophone Canada by essentially bringing in people who they could one way or another bribe, you know, with government subsidies and so on. Yeah. And that's essentially what's happened. You have these various redoubts of immigrants all over Western Canada, which is a major factor in the Liberals holding on there.
Yeah, the stresses you talked about in the United States are becoming apparent in Canada between the regions or even the provinces and the cultures here. And I suspect that maybe in a more docile way, we're headed to some sort of a crisis in Canada of the same sort. How do you see a breakup of the United States, a possible breakup of the United States, affecting Canada? Or do you foresee perhaps parts of Canada joining parts of America if we sort of scramble this whole equation?
Yes, I do. I've always thought that's a possibility in various different ways. I mean, my first wife was a Newfoundlander, and you know the Confederation has been a complete disaster for Newfoundland and for as it has been for the Maritimes generally. It's just reduced them to dependent status. Yeah. I think so that they would be much better off in with free trade with the U.S. It's often said, you know, that there's a possibility of a Pacific alliance develop in the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia and Alberta, yeah. and Alaska have a great deal in common. But you know, I wouldn't rule out Ontario being the first to want to join the U.S. Yeah. Because they've had a happy experience with Confederation and they think of themselves as competitors are on the same level as Washington and a great deal of Canadian intellectual life is just basically America envy. I could see it working out in various ways. The problem is that the U.S. itself is in trouble now, so we may just see boundaries redrawn right across North America and regardless of the 49th parallel in various different ways.
Well, you described yourself.
Well, you could move towards a European Union situation, not the European Union that they want to move to, but the European Union as it's existed for the last 20, 30 years, which is that you have sovereign states that have a common market and so on.
That was the Quebec, I think, the message coming out of Quebec from some of the sovereigntists, that we can do it that way. And I think as time has gone by, I think people look upon that in a more favorable stance. I know living here now in Alberta, I think people in Alberta would be happy to have a common market with Quebec. But if we're not going to share the same values, then perhaps we should go our own way.
Yes. I mean, it's amazing to me that Alberta in particular stayed in Confederation at all, because they're clearly net losers from it, and they could do perfectly well by themselves. I mean, the Americans, after all, do the, you know, for Canada subcontracts its defense to the Americans. It's the American military that's basically responsible for peace and security in North America, and that wouldn't be any different if Alberta were independent.
Well, you've described yourself as a contrarian, and I think today you've lived up to your own billing. And Peter, it's been an interesting exchange of ideas, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of feedback on it. As a journalist and a person who believes in these things, I'm glad we're finally having some of these discussions. Whether I agree with you on everything or disagree with you, it's, you know, that's something else. But there you go.
I'm prepared to wait for another 20 years, Bruce.
You've been listening to The Full Count with Bruce Dobigan. Our guest today has been author Peter Brimelow. Now, don't forget to subscribe to The Full Count and all our podcasts at our website, anticanetwork.com, or at iTunes. Also, some exciting news. I'm now appearing 3 times a week with Jeff Sammet on Sirius XM Radio Channel 167, Canada Talks. I'll be on at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And I'll post our conversations on my website and on my Facebook page. Till next time, this is Bruce Dobigan, and remember, the story isn't complete till it reaches The Full Count.